Hello, I'm Neil Denny, and you're about to listen to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm in Chicago, and I spent the morning at the University of Chicago in the company of Jerry Coyne. Jerry Coyne is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago, where he specialises in evolutionary genetics. His research focuses on the origin of new species, using the fruit fly, Drosophila, as a model organism. Jerry Coyne has taught evolutionary biology for more than 25 years, and has contributed frequently to the public debate concerning evolution and creationism. He has published widely in research journals and is the author, with Alan Orr, of Speciation, now the standard academic text in the subject. He was elected a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2007, and Jerry is the author of the book Why Evolution is True, which is what we mainly talk about in this interview. I'm sat in the office of Jerry Coyne. Jerry, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
My pleasure.
We're going to be talking mainly around your excellent book, Why Evolution is True. Let's talk first of all about why is a book called Evolution is True necessary in the 21st century?
Well, it shouldn't be. We don't have a book called Why Atoms are True or Why Infectious Microorganisms are True. It's because, uniquely amongst the sciences, evolution is rejected, spurned, despised in the United States. I was hoping when I wrote the book, largely because people were ignorant of the evidence, so I thought that if I gave them the evidence in a sort of accessible and popular way, that they would become less resistant to evolution.
But is that not happening?
Well, I mean, look, I can't expect the national acceptance of evolution to spike because of a book. I'm glad I did it, because a lot of people have written me and said, yes, you know, I used to doubt evolution, or I accepted it, but I didn't know what the evidence is, but now I'm firmly convinced. And I've made some converts from creationists, but in terms of raising the national consciousness as a whole about this, there's a big block towards that, which is the fact that America is a very religious country, and religion is the main impediment to accepting evolution.
So let's talk a little bit about that then. I was going to say, well, you know, what is it about evolution particularly? You just mentioned the fact that there isn't a book about why we believe in quantum theory, why we believe in atomic theory. Let's talk a little bit about why evolution in particular.
Well, it's pretty obvious, actually. It's because people are taught, or have been taught by the tenets of their faith, how they came to be. And evolution contravenes basically everything that at least Scripture says, but it certainly takes away from humanity the notion that we're special creatures, which is the lesson of almost every religion. It has implications, many people think, for morality, behavior that people don't like we're animals, we're primates. Our morality is probably an evolved rather than a God-given phenomenon. We're not the center of the universe or the special objects of God's attention. All those things sort of hit religion in the solar plexus. So there is no other area of science, except perhaps cosmology, that is so inimical to what people want to believe about their futures, their being in the hands of a divine being, etc. So I think that's the reason why evolution is uniquely rejected by, you know, in this country at least.
I want to spend some time perhaps briefly just looking at some of the background to which mm-hmm. you're trying to teach evolution. And mm-hmm. you talk in the book about the recent Dover, Pennsylvania mm-hmm. school board case. Just briefly give us a description of what happened there.
Well, in that case, the school board, which was rife with religious people, decided to make readings in intelligent design available to in a public school, high school. And intelligent design, which you and your listeners all certainly know, is a sort of form of creationism. It's been called creationism in a cheap tuxedo. So they adopted this textbook called The Pandas and People, which if you read it, I mean, I reviewed it in the New Republic some years ago. It's just an execrable piece of work, which is basically creationism that's been gussied up a bit. In fact, that book had its genesis as a creationist book, and they just changed the words to make it intelligent design. And that's a violation in this country of the First Amendment, separation of church and state. So the courts have repeatedly found that any kind of religiously motivated biology cannot be taught in the classrooms, because it's, you know, they don't have that in the UK, for example, where they do teach. Mm-hmm. They could. I'm not sure they do. But in the States, if you try to do that, it's illegal. It's an incursion of religion into the public sphere, which is not mandated. And the school board should have known that. And they could have saved themselves a lot of trouble if they just buckled down when the lawsuit was filed against them by a group of concerned parents. I think there were five of them who just didn't want their kids to be taught, you know, lies and religiously based lies. So at a huge expense to the taxpayers of Dover, There was this big trial, and it was like the Latter-day Scopes trial. You know, it's the biggest trial we've had in the past 20 or 25 years about this issue, which keeps flaring up again and again and again, because religious people will never relent until their theories are allowed to be presented as scientific fact. So there was a long trial. There was a lot of good and articulate scientists who testified. The defense was kind of lackluster. They presented, for example, Michael Behe, who apparently just collapsed under questioning and admitted that, I think it was that astrology could qualify as science under his definition. Anyway, the judge, who was a Republican and thought she was rather conservative, decided that this was indeed a violation of the church-state thing, and the school board lost. The textbook was not allowed to be used, and the school board had to pay the money for the trial because they incurred the damages, which was millions of dollars, I think. And, of course, that was a severe blow to the education of, you know, the local kids, because that money comes out of the school funds. So it was a lesson to school boards not to do this kind of stuff. I mean, they should have known that to begin with, but they were foolish.
So a great victory for science and reason there, but it does carry on. I mean, wasn't the end. It continues.
I mean, I used the analogy, I think, in the book of creations. I don't know if they have these toys anymore, but when I was a kid, we had these like 5-foot-tall inflatable rubber clowns, and you'd hit them, and they'd roll over, and then they'd pop back up again. And that's what creationism is like in America. You knock it down, it'll always come back in a slightly different guise. I mean, I've lived through several phases of this. It used to be just straight creationism, and then scientific creationism with Henry Morris, and then intelligent design, which is the latest incarnation. It's all the same stuff, but couched in different words to make people think it's something different. And now we have stuff like teach the controversy. Since intelligent design is not flying, now people just say, well, teach the controversy about evolution, teach all sides, you know, that is the newest incarnation. That hasn't yet been tested in the courts, but I doubt it will fly. There are some states, I think Kentucky, where you've just been, and Tennessee, have just passed laws saying that teachers cannot be prohibited from teaching the controversy, which is a thinly disguised attempt to get creationism back into the classroom.
God, I hate asking this question. What would be wrong with that, then? What would be wrong with teaching the controversy in the classroom?
Well, two things wrong. First of all, there is no controversy in biology, at least, about the major tenets of evolution. I mean, whether evolution happened largely by natural selection, that it was gradual, that we all have common ancestry. I mean, that's not controversial, and that's the stuff that they want to get rid of. Basically, they want the idea that God created things either in a progressive fashion or instantaneously. So teaching the controversy is teaching controversy doesn't exist. So that's scientifically untenable. I mean, there are real controversies in evolutionary biology that could be taught, like how much of human behavior is due to our ancestry in the savannah, how much of it is a cultural overlay, what are the human ethnic groups that differ in various physiological and physical traits, what was the cause of that, what is the human family tree, we don't even know which of the fossils is our lineage. Those are all controversies that are really sort of fruitful and interesting, but that's not what these people want to teach. The second thing wrong with that strategy is that, besides giving kids the misidea that there is a controversy about whether evolution is true, is that it just confuses children by throwing together good science with pseudoscience and then not giving them the tools to sort it out with. So it's doing something like that is like saying in a psychology class you would teach astrology and let the kids decide which one. Or teach Christian science and faith healing in medical school. And, you know, and let the doctors sort it out. You know, that's just not a tenable way to have an education. You always try to present the best thought in the field at the time. And that's not by giving them a bunch of discredited views and letting the kids decide what's right, you know.
Okay, evolution then. Let's do evolution 101. So back to basics. What is evolution?
Well, as I just mentioned, it's the theory of evolution as a, well, the Darwinian theory. We call it Darwinian, but of course it's been updated because Darwin didn't know about genetics. In my book, I describe it as sort of a 5-part theory. It includes the proposition that, first of all, evolution happened, which is what most people think of as the theory of evolution. And by evolution, we now know that that means genetic change in populations. Darwin didn't know about genetics. I mean, he knew that there was things that were inherited from parent to offspring, but we can now describe it more succinctly as genetic change in populations. The second proposition is that that change occurs by the transformation of populations over long periods of time. And by long periods of time, I mean hundreds to thousands to millions of years. It's not an instantaneous change. And the third part is that there is a splitting process that goes on. We started like 3.5 billion years ago with a single organism, and now we have like 7 million species. That's a conservative estimate. So how did that happen? Well, obviously, these lineages had to divide over time to give us the present species. So besides just the change in a single lineage, which we think of as evolution, we have the division of lineages into what we know of as the tree of life. So we're all branches, terminal twigs on that tree. The fourth tenet is sort of the reverse of the third tenet, which is if you trace any pair of twigs in that tree back to the branches and to the trunks, you'll find that there's a common point where they all intersect. That's common ancestry. So we branch, but the conclusion for that branching process is that you can take any two of those branches and trace them back in time and find a common ancestor. That's really the same thing, it's just said in another way, but it makes predictions that you can look for these common ancestors in the history of life. And the fifth tenet of the modern theory of evolution is that a lot of the change and all of the change in which organisms have been made to appear exquisitely fitted to their ways of life, all these marvelous adaptations that things have, like the fins of fishes and the spines of cacti, that those have occurred through a process called natural selection. So that is not what we think of as the only process that's caused evolution, but it's the only process we think that has caused the adaptive evolution, the sort of fit of organisms with their environments that was once the most convincing evidence for the presence of God. So, I mean, that's, again, one reason why evolution is so inimical to religious people, because it's taken away their strongest evidence that they ever had for God, which was the design argument. So those are the five parts of evolution, which, as I said before, still stand up. None of them have been refuted, and there are other ancillary things that have been added to it. We know there's a form of natural selection called sexual selection, which is based on mate choice. We know how genes work. We know that a large part of evolution doesn't occur through natural selection, but through just random shufflings of genes that don't have any real effect on organisms' reproductive ability. So that's what's been called neo-Darwinism, which is simply the flushing out of those 5 points by modern discoveries in genetics and paleontology, etc.
You mentioned natural selection, so people often confuse the evolution and natural selection. Yeah. I think that's the same thing. And natural selection was basically Darwin's big idea. He wasn't the first person to think of evolution, was he? Let's talk about
His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, had the same idea. The idea of evolution was in the air, clearly, when Darwin wrote his book. And in fact, he wasn't the first person to think of natural selection either. Alfred Russel Wallace hit on it. Well, actually, Darwin probably did. Wallace thought of it in about 1858. And wrote to Darwin about it. Darwin had had this idea for at least a decade before that, but he didn't publish it. So they both sort of published the idea at the same time. Darwin gets the credit for it. He considered it, I think, his greatest contribution, and it probably was, because it shows that through a purely materialistic and natural process, we get all these amazing plants and animals that, I mean, it's just an unbelievably impressive thing that this process of gene sorting could create these appearances of design. And it took a long time for that to catch on. The idea of evolution was basically accepted by most thinking people and even most theologians within a decade after Darwin proposed it. Natural selection took a lot longer to catch on and, in fact, was not widely accepted in the Western world until about 1920 and 1930, which is about 60 years after Darwin's book was published.
So what was it that caused natural selection to be more accepted then at that point?
Well, just because, first of all, we had evidence for it. Second of all, we could do it in the laboratory, although breeders had been selecting for a long time and seeing. One of the main reasons was the rediscovery of genetics in 1900 by three independent investigators and the ability to connect the genes with the forces that were acting on those genes. So we had a complete picture all the way from the hereditary material itself to how the organisms could change over time. So there was no impediment. Before that, people thought, for example, that there were teleological forces that just drove evolution, that there was some internal drive that made organisms change in a certain direction. There was a natural selection. The classic example is the saber-toothed tiger. The theory is that the teeth just got bigger and bigger and bigger by some vitalistic force, and finally they couldn't open their mouths and they starved to death. Well, we know that's not true now, but we didn't have the knowledge of the hereditary material or how evolution could actually work on a mechanistic level. So when that was finally in place in the first couple decades of the 20th century, then natural selection became less resisted.
So you mentioned that there are other processes apart from natural selection through which evolution works. So let's look at some of those. And you mentioned sexual selection. We often see things like, the classic example is the peacock. You know, a peacock is encumbered by these, you know, ridiculously big tail feathers that make it, you know, impossible for it to fly. So let's talk about how sexual selection benefits those, because actually that looks like it's
it's maladaptive. Yeah. Well, actually, you drew a distinction between sexual selection and natural selection, but they're not really different. Sexual selection is a subset of natural selection. So when I talked about other processes, I meant something else, but we can talk about that later. So sexual selection is a subset of natural selection. It's basically defined as natural selection based on mate choice. So there's lots of things that go into making one gene better than the other. If it's an effect on survival, which can be like how many kids you have, how well fed you are, how well you are from hiding from predators, etc. But one thing included in natural selection that makes genes replicate faster than others, which is evolution, is your ability to find a mate. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't find a mate, you don't leave your genes. So anything that you have that makes you more attractive to the opposite sex is going to be favored by natural selection. Now, I use the word natural selection as if it is some sort of force acting on organisms, and I want to not really give your listeners that impression, because natural selection isn't something that comes from the outside. It's what happens when there are genes that have different effects on the organism, and some of them have better effects than others, and those ones that do leave more copies of themselves. So it's not a force acting on an organism, it's a process of gene sorting based on the differential ability of the different kinds of genes to leave copies of themselves. So in sexual selection, you leave a copy of yourself by simply making yourself more attractive to a mate. Now, it turns out, for reasons that may be too arcane to go into, that the way it works in animals, at least, is that the males have to be attractive to the females. The females are the choosers, and the males are the people who present themselves, look at me, choose me. That's all devolves ultimately to the difference in the investment between males and females. Females have a few eggs that are expensive, and humans, they get pregnant. Males can impregnate gazillions of females if they want. Females cannot have gazillions of offspring, so they have to be careful about who they choose. And the males are selected to be profligate. They just want to spread their genes. So that's the whole basis of sexual selection. And so because the females are choosy and the males need to be chosen, they will be selected if they have any trait that makes them more attractive to females. So that's sexual selection, and it leads to things like the peacock's tail. But it does so in a lot of different ways, and we don't fully understand the different ways it works. I mean, why exactly is that big tail attractive to females? We know it is, because if you artificially make them bigger or add extra eye spots to the tail, the females will choose the males. But the evolutionary basis for why a female would choose these bizarre characters, these long tails, these claws, there's lots of theories, and in very few cases we understand it. But in the case of the peacock, we don't. All we know is that having a bigger tail makes the male attractive. And we know that the female likes that, but we're not sure why the female has evolved to like that particular trait, as opposed to a crest or a call or simply a male that jumps up and down faster, like in the prairie chicken. So, but sexual selection is a very important force in evolution, because it's the explanation for why we have all these traits like the peacock's tail. Darwin once wrote famously that, because before he had figured out sexual selection, and he published this in 1871, which is 12 years after his first book, before he had figured out how it worked, he said the sight of a peacock's tail made him sick. He couldn't figure it out. It drove him nuts. And he finally, his understanding was not as sophisticated as ours is today, but there is this problem of why males and females are different, and different in ways in which usually the males are gaudier, have plumage, they do things to attract females, they have loud calls, they have battles with each other, you know, all that stuff. That's hard to explain by simple natural selection alone, unless you realize that one subset of natural selection includes finding mates. And when you realize that, and then have the additional realization that the way that males and females reproduce is different. The males produce a lot of cheap sperm, females some expensive eggs, but ineluctably lead to a situation in which you have males evolving all these bizarre things to attract females. Now, the peacock's tail looks maladaptive, and it is in some ways. I mean, a peacock, if you can go on YouTube, you'll see when a peacock, and they can fly, but when they try to, they're really awkward. And they need to fly sometimes to get away from predators, but they can't do it very well. And when they get wet, you don't have to fly, but you have that big tail that's sodden and everything. So you think, well, how can natural selection produce something that's maladaptive? Well, it turns out it's not maladaptive. It's maladaptive for flying, but it more than compensates for that by attracting females. Those traits wouldn't evolve unless the ability to attract females more than compensated for the ability to hurt males. So you get all these traits in males that do impede them in some ways, but they also give them a leg up, or actually it gives them their genes up by helping them find mates. So So that was the explanation that helped Darwin recover from his illness about the peacock's tail. So.
What about those other processes then? You mentioned that...
Well, there's really only one that we think of as important. It's called genetic drift. And it's basically, if genes don't have a very big effect on survival and reproduction, and there's lots of ways you can see a gene would do that. And genes are composed of strings of DNA and triplet code. And it turns out that, you know, you have, well, there's four bases, but and they come in groups of three, and each three of them make an amino acid. But it turns out that the third base is largely redundant. So whether you have base X or base Y there, you'll produce the same protein, which means that you'll have the same effect on the organism. So if you have a mutation that changes that position in the DNA, and there's lots of positions in the DNA that are third positions, one third of all of our genome that codes for genes is in that position, then it's going to be what we call neutral, has no effect on the organism. So you'll have all this molecular turnover and mutations that are not seen by natural selection and will cause molecular evolution to occur. There's also huge swaths of the genomes, I think over 90% in our own genome, that don't code for anything at all. They're just spacer regions. They're remnants of ancient parasitic infections. They're what we call junk. And so any kind of mutation in those regions will not be affected by natural selection. So what happens is you get this continual evolution, because it is evolution. We define evolution as change in genes, but it's not evolution that's caused by natural selection. It's just a random shuffling by chance of mutations that have no effect on the organism whatsoever. Now you think, well, okay, so why do we care about that? Well, it's important because you can show theoretically and empirically that the kinds of changes that are not affected by natural selection will change linearly with the passage of time. So the amount of difference between any two species that have a common ancestor will accumulate completely linearly with time. So what happens if you can look at those parts of the DNA and measure how different they are, and you know how fast that difference accumulates, you can date how old they are. And that's the way that people make phylogenetic or family trees of organisms now. So it's actually fortunate that there is this evolutionary process that isn't based on natural selection, because we can use it not only to date organisms, but the family trees. I mean, it was only when I was in graduate school that biologists used that kind of non-functional DNA to realize that our closest relative was a chimpanzee rather than the gorilla. And it's because if you look at those non-important positions, our genetic similarity is closer to that of chimps than it is from gorillas. So you can conclude that we've diverged from chimps more recently than when we diverged from gorillas. Ergo, our closest relative is the chimp. So this is done, you know, for primates. That's the way all biologists now conclude relatedness. And we can get estimates of when we diverged from these animals. From chimps, it's probably about 5 million years. So although it's not important in terms of design of an organism or natural selection, it is important in helping us reconstruct the history of life.
I want to look at some of the evidence that shows us that evolution and natural selection is working. You've just been talking for a while about DNA. That was one of the ones I was going to cover, so we won't look at that. But let's talk about fossils for a bit. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how we can look at the fossil record and see the evidence.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's one of these things that makes you feel really lucky as a scientist to know that fossils actually exist. I mean, we would still know that evolution had happened without a fossil record, because we have the traces in our genome, because there's all these other lines of evidence I talk about in my book. But there's an effect that you have to actually see a preserved organism from millions of years ago that is much more convincing to people than these other kinds of data. So we have a good fossil record. Well, not so good, really. I mean, it's been estimated anywhere between 0.01% and 1% of all the species that ever lived are known to us as fossils. Most of them are either buried too deep, or they didn't get fossilized, or they were fossilized but the grinding of the Earth's crust destroyed them. So we have an imperfect window on the history of life, but it's clear enough that we can not only trace what happened over time, but we can verify, make predictions about what happened and verify them by digging in certain areas of the rock. So, I mean, one of the greatest things to happen in terms of buttressing the theory of evolution since Darwin wrote his book was the development of a good fossil record. He didn't have one. And if you read The Origin of Species, you'll see there's almost nothing about fossils in there. There's stuff about the geological column, which had fossils in them, but geology and paleontology were not well enough developed to be able to use them to provide evidence for evolution. But now we have plenty of sequences that will document evolution. I talk about some in my book. I can mention a few if you'd like.
Please do.
Well, even in my lifetime, the human fossil record, it started in the 1920s when they dug up Australopithecus in South Africa, but Darwin predicted in 1871 that because what looked like to be our closest relatives, which were chimps and gorillas, at least things that looked more similar to us, were in Africa, that humans probably evolved in Africa too. We had no evidence for that. And then all of a sudden you start digging up fossils, and we sent expeditions there starting in the 20s, and lo and behold, yeah, there they are, and you can date them, because that's the other side of the fossil record. We don't only have the fossils, but we have a way of dating when a fossil was made using this radiometric dating technique, which I'm sure was impugned on your visit to the Creation Museum. But it's actually been cross-tested many times. It's quite accurate. So in my lifetime, we have a human fossil record, and we have this amazing discovery that we have three or four different branches living at the same time in Africa. We're not quite sure which one is the one that gave rise to Homo sapiens, but it's a puzzle that will probably be sorted out in the next 20 or 30 years. We have also the genetic evidence now that we can trace where different fossils came from and when we left Africa and things like that. So that's one prediction. There's the fossil record. Well, we have every transitional form that you can imagine has been found in the last 40 or 50 years. So, for example, the transition onto land from fish to amphibians. Neil Shubin, whose office is right next door, found a really good example of a, he calls it a fishapod, because it has both amphibian and fish-like characteristics. It's exactly what you'd predict if we descended from fish. And, of course, you see fish in the fossil record 400 million years ago, and you don't see amphibians until a lot later. So you predict if you look intermediate those times, you're going to find maybe the transitional forms, and that's what you find. So we have this link between fish and amphibians. We have links between amphibians and reptiles. Reptiles and mammals, we have the so-called mammal-like reptiles, things that we have lineages that are well documented, that are, in which the change from a reptilian form to a mammalian form is so gradual over millions of years that you cannot draw a line and say, this is a mammal, this is a reptile. You have, that's why they call them mammal-like reptiles. Evolution of birds from reptiles, also thought to have been happened, theorized by Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's contemporary. And in fact, they had one of the crucial fossils at that time, Archaeopteryx, which is basically a dinosaur with feathers, but they didn't know what it was. In the last 20 or 30 years, we've been finding all these fossils from China, which are basically small bipedal dinosaurs that have begun to have feathers. And the later and later the fossils appear in the fossil record, the better and better the feathers you have. The last example, I think, which has really been sorted out in the last couple of decades, is the evolution of whales from an ancestor that you wouldn't think would be a whale ancestor. It's sort of like a small deer, sort of like the muntjacs of Southeast Asia. So you have this thing that's about 2 feet tall and has hooves. It's an artiodactyl or an even-toed mammal. But it has certain features of the ears and the skull that whales have. And since then, people like Philip Gingrich and Thay Wisson have been digging in places like Pakistan and dating the finds. And then we find a whole complete sequence from these early deer-like animals that become increasingly aquatic. Their limbs get smaller, at least their hind limbs disappear. Their forelimbs turn into flippers. The nostrils move atop the head to form the blowhole. Changes in the ear occur, they lose their external ear. And you can put them all in dating sequence, and when you do that, lo and behold, what we see is a transformation of something like a deer into something like a modern whale. And it happened over a period of only 8 million years, which is not much longer than we took to evolve from our ancestor with the chimpanzees. Now, we're still pretty close to the chimpanzees, but a baleen whale doesn't look anything like a deer. So that's a remarkable amount of evolutionary change to take place. And we have the complete documented fossil record. It always amazes me that people can go to museums. I mean, not the Creation Museum, which is not a real museum. It's a propaganda institute. But to the place like the Smithsonian or the American Museum of Natural History and see these transitional forms and not believe in evolution. I mean, it's amazing to me. I mean, I can understand that you would have blinkers put on you by, say, faith, or, I mean, it's always faith, it's nothing else. But when you see these fossils, it's just hard to deny that evolution occurred.
The other example of evidence I want to look at is something we could perhaps colloquially call things that God probably wouldn't have done, or he wouldn't have done if he was a competent designer. So there are examples in organisms of things that are just like maladaptions, as you said, and atavisms and things like that. Let's think of a couple of examples of things that sort of show God up to be an inept designer, basically.
Yeah. Well, let me preface my answer by saying that when I always make these arguments that there are things that don't look like an intelligent designer would have designed, and our bodies are full of them, I always get criticized because I'm saying that's a theological argument. You're saying that God is going to be a certain way and is going to be an intelligent designer, but we don't know that. Of course, the same people that say that know that God is you know, omnipotent and omniscient. So they know some things about God, but when it comes to whether he's very intelligent in designing bodies, they say, well, we just don't understand. So they say that to invoke that kind of evidence for evolution, the kludges and the glitches and the bad, which are perfectly predictable from evolution, because evolution doesn't work by starting de novo. It takes what you have and transforms into something else. So there's going to be kludges. To say that that's, you know, a theological argument is not correct. And it's not correct for the reason that these kludges that we see are not just mistakes or screw-ups or things that are bad. They're things that are bad and screw-ups that only make sense if you think that organisms evolved. You know, for example, our tailbone of humans. You know, we have this coccyx at the base of our spine, which sticks out. Sometimes it gets bruised. That's not something that a designer would put there. So I could say, well, this is bad design. And the theologian would say, well, you know, wait, you don't know that. God might have been joking that day, or he might have been in a bad mood, or been joking around. But I will say, well, okay, you can say that, but look at our closest relatives. At least in the monkeys, they have tails. And we're thought to have common ancestors that had tails. So it makes perfect sense if what we have descended from things with tails. So our bodies and the bodies of other animals are loaded with these kinds of maladaptations. The nerve that enables me to speak now, the recurrent laryngeal nerve, starts in the brain, but it has to come all the way down around the heart, loop around one of the aorta, and then come back up to the voice box. So there's actually a couple extra feet of nerve there that you don't need. That happened because we evolved from fishes, where the arteries and the nerves were perfectly in line with each other, but then over evolutionary time, the aorta moved backwards or downwards into the body, and the nerve was forced to stay looped around it. So in a giraffe, there's like 15 extra feet of nerve, so that when a giraffe, its nerve that goes to its larynx goes all the way from the head down into the body, up that long neck twice. You can absolutely understand that as evolution, because we know that the aorta move backwards over time, and you can't break a nerve and then reform it. Evolution will not allow you to do that, so it had to be functional the whole time. So this is an example of the kind of bad design that it makes much more sense in light of evolution than just saying, well, God is not necessarily a good designer. Well, if God was a bad designer, you can at least say he designed things badly to make it look as though evolution had occurred. I mean, some of the most powerful evidence is not just those sort of bodily malfunctions, but the genes that we have in our body that are no longer functional, but were functional in our ancestors. And one of the examples I use is that we have three genes for making yolk protein that are active in chickens, and we produce a yolk sac in an embryonic stage, but those genes that we have for making yolk do not produce any product. They've been silenced. They're dead. Why would God put dead genes in our body that don't do anything? Well, you could say he had an off day. You know, we can't fathom the great man's mind. But then you see that these are the same genes that our reptilian ancestors used to lay eggs. So these things make perfect sense in light of evolution. They're all over the place. And that's exactly what we'd expect. I mean, if God was the reason why things were designed, and he was omnipotent, benevolent, we wouldn't see any of these kludges, especially kludges that make it look like evolution occurred. So.
I want to spend some time looking at species, and this is your particular area of research. You focus on speciation, looking at the fruit fly. Mm-hmm. We'll look at that in a moment, but let's first of all tell us, what is a species?
Well, of course, there's many different definitions of species. This is one of the contentious areas of evolutionary biology. Most evolutionary biologists have settled on what we call the biological species definition, which is this, that two animals belong to different species if, in a state of nature where they encounter each other, they're unable to mate and produce a fertile offspring. So we're a different species from a chimpanzee because we can encounter chimps and we don't mate with them, mainly because we don't like to, but we also know what would happen if we did, because there was a Russian zoologist who decided he would inseminate chimpanzees with human sperm, and nothing happened. So even if we did mate with them, you wouldn't get anything. So that's why we're different species. So a species is a community in which every individual within that species can mate with each other. It's sort of a gene pool, and it's distinct from the gene pool of other species because there's no possibility of genes moving from one pool to the other. So that's why robins, for example, well, I know in the UK robins are different species in America, so well, why pigeons and crows are different species? Because they live together. I can go out on campus and find them in the same tree, but you'll never see them mating with each other or producing hybrids. So that's what species are, and the problem for an evolutionist is to explain how you start with a common ancestor and get two things that are no longer reproductively compatible with one another.
So yeah. Let's talk about Drosophila then. Uh-huh. the fruit fly. Why? What can we learn from that? Why is your research particularly focused on that?
Well, that's two different questions. And what can we learn from Drosophila? We've learned almost everything we know about modern genetics from Drosophila, because that was the model organism in the early 1900s. So, for example, we know that genes are on chromosomes, because that was done in Drosophila. We know the genes are linearly arrayed on chromosomes from Drosophila. We know that the chromosomes pair, and they break up and exchange genes between the members, because we have two copies of each chromosome. This process called crossing over recombination. We know that because of Drosophila. Much of the sequencing of genes was first done in Drosophila. So it's a model organism because it breeds so quickly. You can go from an egg to an adult that can lay another egg within 7 to 10 days in my laboratory. I mean, in a year, you can go through 30 or 40 generations, and it makes it experimentally tractable, not only for genetic studies, but for evolutionary studies as well. So what I do with them in my lab is to take pairs of species that do not cross in nature, but can be crossed if you can force them to, because you can do that under artificial conditions, and try to understand how much genetic difference there is between closely related species and what kinds of genes there are that make them reproductively incompatible, where those genes are in the chromosomes, what characters do they affect? Do they affect the fertility of the offspring or the viability of the offspring, or do they affect the willingness of different species to mate with each other? So what I have done most of my career is to try to trace how speciation has occurred by looking at the genetic differences between very closely related species. I mean, it's hard to actually see a speciation event in nature because relative to evolutionary time, it's pretty quick. In flies, it can happen in like 50,000 to a couple hundred thousand years. And compared to the billions of years ago in the fossil record, that's a long time. So only rarely are we able to actually see in the fossil record things forming, splitting. And we have examples of it, so we know it happens. I mean, the evidence really comes from the common ancestry, from the genetic similarity and things like that. But I try to go about it another way by looking at the genes that differentiate species that exist today and find out something about how that process might have occurred.
I want to perhaps spend some time looking at how different species become separated, how they're sort of like geographically separated, for instance, what sort of forces make that happen, and what and how they therefore take on certain, they fill certain niches, for instance. And particularly I want to look at marsupials. Let's focus on the, you know, the continent of Australasia. It's somewhere where completely unique animals are formed, and I wonder why that might have happened.
Well, that's basically contingency and chance. Marsupials did not evolve in Australia. They evolved, well, I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think the first ones are in Asia. It's hard to tell because fossil marsupials differ subtly from fossil placentals, but we know that wherever they started, they wound up in North America, and so we still have them here, the opossum, for example, in South America. There are still marsupials there. And for reasons that we don't understand, it's the marsupials that made it to Australia. So all the continents were connected at a certain time. South America was joined to Antarctica, which was joined to Australia. And the marsupials managed to get to Australia by going through the Antarctic route, which was the joining bridge between Australia and South America. And they just got there first. I mean, this is so much of the story of evolution is just contingency. Who happened to get there? I mean, that's why we have the finches on the Galapagos and the honey creepers in Hawaii. It's not that they were better suited there. It was that they got there first and it was an empty habitat. The marsupials got to Australia and the placentals didn't, or they got there before the placentals did. There were a few placental mammals in Australia, but the marsupials basically got there into an open, empty habitat. And when an animal invades an empty habitat that's as diverse as Australia is, what do? They just start invading all those different niches and splitting and forming new species. And so it's basically chance that Australia has almost every one of its indigenous mammals a marsupial. You know, there's no adaptive explanation for that. It's pure contingency.
Let's spend a little time looking at human evolution then. And this is often the one that people find most contentious. A lot of religious people will accept the fact that evolution happens and it happens to other species, but it's difficult to accept the fact that it happens to humans. So perhaps let's talk a little bit about what evidence can be found in our own bodies that it's actually happening.
Well, I've mentioned some already, which is the fact that we contain genes that are non-functional in us, but that are functional in our ancestors. The yolk protein genes is one. The olfactory receptor genes, if you look at a dog or some animal that really depends on a sense of smell, they have hundreds and hundreds of genes, each one devoted to producing a specific protein that receives a specific odorant And that's why dogs are such good smellers. We have a lot of those genes too, but they're non-functional. I don't remember how many we have, but it's like 1/5 or 1/6 of what we have in dogs. That's because humans don't depend on the sense of smell so much. We depend on vision, and we depend on hearing, and so the odorant genes were no longer needed, and so mutations that randomly inactivated them just, they weren't debilitating. And if you lose your ability to smell something, it doesn't hurt us so much, so it happened. So we have odorant genes that are dead, we have yolk protein genes that are dead, but functional in our ancestors. Another one is the famous vitamin C gene. Primates, many mammals, in fact, vampire bats, and I think guinea pigs, they cannot synthesize vitamin C, but every other mammal can. When you look at why that is, it's because we have the complete vitamin C pathway coded in our DNA, but the last crucial step needed to make that vitamin has been inactivated by a mutation. So why is it that we have this whole biochemical armamentarium in our genome, and yet it doesn't do anything because there's a mutation in the last step, and it happens to be the same mutation that has inactivated the same pathway in chimpanzees? There's only one explanation for that, that we have a common ancestor from the chimpanzees, and that we evolved from something that had a vitamin C pathway that was once useful, but we get enough vitamin C in our diet that we don't need to make it ourselves. So, I mean, our genome is just a graveyard of dead genes that aren't dead, but many of them are functional in our ancestors. So that right away tells us that we have a common ancestry with other species. And then if you look at the similarity of our DNA to that of other animals, you find exactly what you expect, that we're very similar to the chimpanzee, a little less similar to the gorilla, a little less so to the orangutan, less so to other African apes, and even less so to monkeys of the New World. I mean, it's exactly what you'd expect if we were descended from them. So internally, the evidence is very strong that we have common ancestry with these species. And of course, that's buttressed by the fossil record. So we have this consilience of different kinds of evidence. Plus, there's a prediction that we evolved in Africa before they ever found a fossil in Africa. So if you don't like the genetic evidence that I just deduced, go to the museums and have a look at some of the fossils. You can see the pathway where we started out 4 million years ago with a brain the size of a chimpanzee, but we began to have skeletons that are more modern. And as you get more and more closer to recent times, the fossils that we find, while not identical to modern humans, become more and more similar to modern humans. How somebody can look at that and deny that we evolved from a common ancestor with other apes baffles me. I mean, I can understand it, but it just baffles me. People will reject that evidence in a way that they would not reject any other evidence that was so palpable to them.
Is evolution still happening within us? I'd like to perhaps think about if by some incredible chance we are still around, we haven't blown ourselves up in, 100,000 or 1 million years, will we be different to how we are now?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's one I'm always asked when I give a public lecture. And my answer is always the same. It's a two-part answer. A, yes, we're still evolving. And B, where are we going to go? I don't know. We're still evolving because as long as there's genetic variation in the human species, and that genetic variation makes a difference in how you survive and reproduce, then evolution will occur. That's the two prerequisites, genetic variation and for evolution by selection, differential reproduction. And we know from recent studies, two pairs of studies actually, that there is that genetic variation for many traits, and that it is causing evolution in the human species. Not of the dramatic kind, like we're becoming big-brained aliens and everything, but we're becoming more resistant to things like heart disease. I mean, it's exactly what you expect. I mean, now we have this new source of mortality in the human species. We eat too much fat and sweets. We get diabetes and heart disease. That, by the way, is a remnant of our evolutionary past when those valuable commodities were good for us. Now they're not good for us because we can make them and eat them. But they cause us to die, and many of us to die before we're done reproducing. So we can show that there is natural selection acting on human beings in a predicted response. Blood pressure, I believe, is being selected to go down. Coronary artery disease is going down. It's mainly the things you'd expect, the new sources of disease that we have, we're evolving resistance to that. In Africa, there are certain genes that confer resistance to AIDS, and we can see them increasing in frequency over time. That's evolution. I mean, it's not very dramatic, but look, we've only known about genes for 100 years. Evolution takes thousands and millions of years, and no one person is around to see it happen. So we have to, do these longevity studies, vertical studies that doctors do. So yeah, it's still happening. Now, it's also slowed down because a lot of the sources of mortality that used to kill us off are not there anymore. The average lifespan, I think, in medieval England was like 35 to 40 years. People would die of all kinds of diseases, cholera, tuberculosis, tooth disease. I mean, I often think that many of our ancestors died from bad teeth because they didn't have dentists and you didn't have antibiotics. And now, I think it was Dan Dennett, or maybe it was Elliot Sober, I can't remember, somebody was in a room full of people and said, how many of you people would be dead now if it hadn't been for modern medicine? And everybody but one person raised their hand. Our lives have all been saved by antibiotics and things like that. So now, things that used to kill us don't kill us anymore because they have medicine. And those things used to be a potent source of natural selection. But now, look, I have glasses, I have fillings, you know, I have all these things that make me a lot more fit genetically. On the savannah, I'd be a complete loser. I wouldn't be able to see, hunt. You know, I probably wouldn't have any teeth. Somebody would have to give me gruel or something. But now I survive. I don't have any kids, but I could have if I wanted to. So evolution is still happening, but it's a lot slower than it used to be. And we're evolving culturally at a much faster rate than we are. I mean, the ability of the human brain to absorb ideas and change our society that way and our ways of life is much, much faster than our genes could do it. So the interesting way that humans are changing now is not through their genes, but through their culture. So,
just to finish off then, you talked about how evolution is the one area of science that people find it difficult to accept. At the end of the book, there's a quote from Richard Dawkins, which basically boils down to people saying, how do you get up in the morning when you know these facts? So let's talk about how, you know, people think that these ideas somehow detract from the grandeur of life, again, to, mm-hmm. to paraphrase Darwin. So you clearly don't believe this is true.
No, I don't. I can't say that everybody in the world is going to find as much solace in evolution or wonder in evolution as a scientist do, as somebody like Richard or I do. But they certainly can find some. Carl Sagan was, before Richard, was one of the great exponents of the wonder of science. To me, it just seems inconceivably more amazing to think that these exquisite creatures that we see around us resulted from this blind, materialistic, precedential selection than to think that they were poofed into existence. First of all, we know that's the truth, that they did evolve. And then, so that gives us all kinds of mysteries to solve. You know, who's related to what? How did it happen? How did natural selection work this way? When you see a woodpecker beating its skull against a piece of wood, you wonder, well, how did that evolve, you know? And this provides lots of us fertile questions to ponder. And when you just see some of the amazing contrivances, like the bucket orchid, which is an orchid that gets fertilized because it leads a bee into its petally recesses. The bee goes through this labyrinth, which it can't back out, falls into a bucket of water, which is the orchid's part of the orchid's petal, and then it has to crawl out through another exit, and as it does that and shakes itself off, the pollen from the orchid gets attached to the back of the bee. And if you look at this thing, and I urge the readers to just Google image bucket orchid just to see how amazingly complex this thing is, and realize this thing evolved from some other kind of flower, and each of these steps to make this labyrinth was favored by natural selection. That's so much more amazing to me than thinking, well, God just did it because that's what he wanted in his head. I mean, it's a simplistic explanation, it's a wrong explanation, and it's an explanation which isn't fertile in the sense of inspiring our imagination. So I have no problem finding solace in evolution, and I think these sort of mythological stories and holy books and stuff may have some benefits in terms of morality, but they're not inspiring in the way evolution is. In terms of the other stuff that's supposed to be bad for people about evolution, that it takes away your morality, you know, it makes you not special, and it turns you into an atheist. Well, for some people it does do that, and I think people can deal with that. If you look at the countries of Northern Europe, like Scandinavia, Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, they're largely countries that A, are not religious, and B, accept evolution. Those things are, by the way, negatively correlated in the world. The countries that are the most accepting of evolution are the least religious. They are not hotbeds of sin and immorality. The people are not brooding nihilists who are going around worrying about their lives and not having any meaning. I mean, Swedes and Danes have lots of meaning in their lives. So it's not necessary that evolution be such a horrible thing for people. To me, it's a source of wonder, but even if you don't find it a source of wonder, it need not take away purpose, meaning, and value from people's lives. That's what I try to tell them. But if you're brought up believing otherwise, I mean, there's this huge power of brainwashing. What you're told when you're a kid, you tend to retain. That's evolutionary too, by the way. We come into this world knowing nothing and being virtually helpless, and the way around that is you learn from your elders and you believe what they tell you. Well, one of the bad side effects of that is that if your elders figure out something wrong about the world, that there's a sky fairy and he's designed all life and you're going to live on after you die, well, you tend to accept that, and you tend to accept it hard and fast. And so that's the burden that people like me have to overcome when we try to get people to accept evolution.
That's a great point for us to end. So, Jerry Coyne, thanks very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
My pleasure.
I'm Kip Thorne, and that was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.